It's that time of year when school is starting up again. And it's not just about getting school supplies and clothes together. It also means getting your kids, or maybe your own brain, ready for school again. So we're going to start today's show off with a math problem. Got your pen and paper? Okay, here we go. So in this problem, there are two cyclists, and they're starting from the same time at opposite ends of a course towards each other. The course is 45 miles long. One cyclist is riding at 14 miles per hour. The second cyclist is riding at 16 miles per hour. How long before they will both meet? Take a moment. Think about it. All right. Well, the answer is an hour and a half. Don't feel bad if you've forgotten everything you should have remembered from math class. I myself had to look up how to think about these problems to solve it. But for most of us in a world where we live in a world where we don't have to calculate that kind of thing. Perhaps the most prudent thing to do would just be signal right and avoid a collision. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and today on Central Standard, we're joined by someone who's trying to make us care about math. Michael Orozco, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you. And to start, why is it so important that I should remember this stuff? Why is math important?
Well, math is important because if you think about how much we use math in a daily, everyday living context, what I drive or what the idea that I want people to think with, especially children, is that it gives you problem-solving skills. Now, you gave this example of cycling, and one thing I want to point out with you is that I work in the area with disadvantaged minority students in inner city. Matt, have you ever went to a cycling store?
Yes, I have.
How cheap are those bikes?
It can depend. It can vary very largely. I know that for some, you can find them like under, $400, but then others, I've heard of $18,000 bikes.
So think about a simple word problem that you gave us, right? You're trying to build this skill just to give us this problem-solving skill, but then you also have to think about the context that you use that word problem. That's very important. Think about some of our inner city kids that are poor, disadvantaged. How many of them do you think can afford a cycle?
I wouldn't even want to hazard a guess.
And see, that's what we were talking about. What I talk about in my research is that as we begin to think about math, we need to think about how we're contextualizing it in our classrooms because it shows up in society.
And so you're a professor at the School of Education at KU.
Yes.
And you studied mathematics initially yourself. What got you into mathematics?
Well, one of the issues I had earlier on as a teacher is that my research background is there's this phenomenon, and it's really a civil rights issue. The courts have deemed this as this idea of minority disproportionality in special ed, that on any given day, more than likely, if you're African-American, Latino, or Native American, you may run a higher risk of being put in a math learning disabilities category, not based on characters inherent to your disability, but based on your racial background, which relates to how we perceive kids learn. And so as I was a special ed teacher in Denver Public Schools, the schools that I was placed, we were always dealing with compliance issues. And one issue that I was always bringing attention to the folks doing the assessment, the school personnel, like the school psych and the speech language pathologist, was how did you assess motivation? And there would be a pause. What do you mean motivation? I said, because motivation is a big characteristic of how well we're going to perform on an academic task. If you don't look at motivation, then how do we know if the child has a true disability or just wasn't challenged enough or just checked out on you on a daily basis? So as we went through this process and I would get to meet more personnel, a lot of them would come back and tell me, you know what, Michael? We really don't have a lot of good instruments that I can use. A lot of these instruments are 80, 100 items long, and I can't give a motivation instrument. It's going to take me 90 minutes or 2 hours to do this. We just don't have the time. That was a problem. That was a big problem for us when I was teaching. It continues to be the challenge because a lot of these instruments that we're using in schools have to be specialists using these instruments. You know, they have to be developed with some type of scientific method or research rigor.
And when you talk about instrument, when you say instruments, you mean assessments, tests.
Assessments. And then another thing to think about, Matt, is that in schools, a lot of the assessments we're doing, and some of my friends who are in the field of ed psych, we talk about this educational psychology, is that we're really not looking at cognitive development. We're looking at curriculum-based measurements. That's different than looking at cognitive development. Motivation, because it's a latent construct, is a cognitive factor. It's a variable that we need to be constantly looking at. But because we didn't have the instrument, we weren't able to assess it quickly. It took a specialist. We weren't doing that in my teaching days. Well, I had that idea back in my head about 15 years ago that if I ever got the opportunity to develop some type of motivation instrument related to math, that I would do it because it was well needed. And then another thing I pointed out is that a lot of these instruments we use in schools have never been normed on minority populations.
What do you mean by that, norm?
Meaning that when you norm them, if you decide to develop some items and you don't test them, you test them on population X, you can't assume that that same construct is going to work with population Y. A lot of these instruments that we use on schools get normed on typical middle-class white kids. And then we assume it's going to work, that same that characteristic, that instrument is going to adequately measure the same characteristic that you're looking at in minority populations. And that is a big problem for a lot of our assessments out there, is that a lot of them haven't ever been normed on minority populations. So that was a big issue. And then the cost, the motivation tests out there were very costly. So a few years ago, I wrote a grant with a colleague of mine, Lee Swanson, at the University of California, Riverside. And the idea with this was that we're going to start developing motivation interventions, math interventions. And one of this came out this idea of what I refer to as the beams, or I've called the beams.
Like beams on a house, like the
it's
beams
a play on words. It's a play on words because when I work with teachers, we talk about theories, and there's two ways of looking at motivation, and it relates to intelligence. One side, if you believe, Matt, that intelligence is fixed, that means you're believing that kids come into a classroom with a fixed intelligence. You can't change that. If you believe that intelligence is incremental, that you can be good at cycling by not only training but also practicing every day, you can become a better cycle. Motivation follows that pattern, whether you have people that believe you're motivated, that's fixed, or you have incremental.
Mm-hmm. And so
the beams came out of this idea that one day, and I remember Vincent, one of my fifth graders, I was talking to him why it was important they were doing math, why we needed to do word problems. I was explaining to him that they needed to figure out how to do word problems because in middle school they were going to have to begin to develop pre-algebra skills and algebra skills to try to do calculus. And as I was speaking to Vincent, these students, I was trying to build this idea that they needed to do math because it's very important to have very good math skills, problem-solving skills, so you could get a better job. So Vincent, picture this fifth grader who was, I remember him, I always remember because he stood out. He was a real joker. He says, "So if I'm good at math, Mr. O, I can buy beamers?" And I said, "What do you mean beamers?" And these are inner-city kids. I said, "What do you mean beamers?" He says, "A BMW." I said, "Yep, you can buy beamers." So I was sitting in my office when I was looking at this data, and one of my doc students said, "You know, Michael, this looks pretty good. I think it's going to turn out to be a good instrument." And she says, "You know, Jennifer says, she says, but you can't name it the math measurement survey. That's kind of boring." So I sat down, thought about Vincent's comments. If you look at it, Matthew, the beams, mm-hmm. beliefs, engagement, and attitude, math motivation scale. I owe that to Vincent, that idea with the title.
Oh, that's awesome. And so talk to me about the role that motivation does play in the acquisition of math skills.
Well, motivation, one thing to think about is that as schools are providing more frequent exposure to problem solving, which we're seeing now earlier on elementary, middle school, as they become more cognitive load heavy, as we give them more exposure to these problem solving tasks were not only children and students, but teachers to think about mathematics more complexly, with more complexity. However, as we expose them to more challenging tasks, what do you think is going to happen to the motivation earlier on?
I would imagine it will be perceived as harder, and it might be hard to keep up that motivation.
Exactly. And that's one of the biggest challenges, that if you think about the NCLB era, we went back to the basics. The problem is that while we exposed disadvantaged students back to the basics, just basic math skills, we knew it wasn't good enough, right? Because we knew that their privilege counterparts were having more experiences to develop problem-solving skills. Now we're coming back and doing more challenging tasks. But the issue I see now around motivation is that as we begin to do more heavier word problems at the elementary level, we're also going to task students and teachers' motivation to teach math.
Mm. And when you use the word motivation, are you thinking about it in the kind of common way that we think about, like, our own personal motivations to, you know, like, get up in the morning and do X, Y, and Z? Or are you thinking about the word motivation in a slightly different, more refined, or, like, scientific kind of way?
Well, see, and that was one of the reasons I did this study, because I'm a researcher. I apply a scientific method to it, so I can, when somebody comes out and question it, I have data to show, no, I went through the process of using the scientific method. We normed this on a culturally linguistically diverse population. This is just a good general math motivation survey. We got it down to 10 items. And I'm finding, to your question, is that, for example, if a student says, I do not care how well I do in math, math is not important. Or they come back and say, I really want to do well in math. Math is important. That's an important mathematical motivation characteristic we should be paying attention earlier on.
Mm. And so when you see what I imagine would be like a warning sign, a red flag, if a student were to reply, you know, math isn't important, I just don't care. What are some of the interventions that you do once you've done this assessment to figure that out?
So one thing I have, and we haven't talked about, is that the BEAMS fits into a larger project I have. And in fact, KU Today should publish an article. Mike Kring's doing it. I think it's coming out later in the week on my dynamic strategic math project, which has been cited by the U.S. Department of Education as an evidence-based practices. Within that, if you have a child or a group of children that begin to show demotivation, what I've been doing is I've been pulling them out, working with them in small groups. We teach them the complexities of how to go about solving a word problem. And we're finding that when we do the small group instruction, we provide extra instructional scaffolding to the students, and we reduce the mismatch between what is being taught and what the children, their background knowledge, bring to the table. We're finding that that's improving their motivation pre and post design.
You were mentioning that kind of disconnect between what is being taught and, you know, their lived experience. Are you referring a little bit to, for example, the problem we gave at the beginning, you know, talking about cycling might be, you know, a question that isn't appropriate for or doesn't have the kind of the same application or lived experience for one population versus another?
Well, what I tell folks, it's appropriate, because guess what, Matt, this is going to show up again. These type of problems are going to show up again. But if you can't get students, the question I ask first is, what's the number one item to develop comprehension in children that we look over and over? The literature continues to say comprehension develop is how well a school teachers use a student's background knowledge. So if you cannot connect the materials you're using in the classroom to what they're experiencing every day, guess what happens the second they leave the classroom?
It doesn't apply to them.
And I'll give you some data from the U.S. Department of Education coming out. And this just gets me mad. And this is just some of the more recent data coming out. Today, only 2.2% of Latinos, 2.7% of African Americans, and 3.3% of Native Americans and Alaska Natives have earned a first university degree in natural sciences or engineering by age 24. This is also that's really has me thinking more and more about why we need to look at motivation as a mediator to math, higher math skills. Women make up the majority of students on college campuses today and about 46% of the workforce, but they represent less than 20% of the bachelor's degree recipients in fields like computer science and engineering and hold less than 25% of STEM jobs. So for me, if you ask me, part of what I see in classrooms is, yeah, we're presenting more challenging materials like word problems earlier on, but we're not making it culturally relevant to a lot of our changing our diversity in society. That's a big challenge.
Mm-hmm. Whose responsibility is it to motivate these students to get to help change that pattern? Is that squarely a teacher responsibility as you see it, or something a little bit different?
Why? Because problem solving, academic problem solving, for most part is a school construct. I talk to folks and I say, you know what, I think this is a school thing that we can address earlier on and take the lead. Because if I'm an everyday working class parent, you know, trying to make ends meet and I have two jobs, I'm probably not going to have a lot of time to sit there and try to work with my student on some of these problems, word problems that we're asking. I had, for example, Matt, I don't know how well you know policy. We're coming over now into this Common Core math, which some people have issues with it because it's more discovery, more constructivist. I look at it and I see them. It seems like it's going to be, we need to move away from back to the basics. But I said, it isn't necessarily the Common Core math that's the problem. Is are we doing the professional development needed to help teachers teach this Common Core math sets to disadvantaged students who may not have the resources to go about learning higher order thinking? And I'll give you an example. I was on a committee before I came here at the University of California, and one of the vice chancellor for research, who's very well known in computers, he came up to me. He says, Mike, what do you know about Common Core? I said, well, I know a lot. We were talking about Common Core. He says, I said, why, Mike? He says, I have a doctorate in computer science from Rutgers University, he says, and I'm sitting down with my sixth grader. These problems are hard. And I said, I get you. I said, Mike, they're difficult. I said, so could you imagine you have a PhD, your wife has a PhD in computer science, and you guys have you're highly skilled. I said, could you imagine the cultural capital, social capital that some of these inner city kids are going to need so we can get them here to the University of Kansas or the University of California, so forth? And he shook his head. He said, I hadn't thought about that. You're right.
Mm-hmm. And how is motivation different in your mind from interest? Like, I feel like you might be suggesting that there is a distinction.
Well, motivation is a mediator. Is one of the mediators, and it's been well established for 50 plus years, to comprehension. So it's a well established literature. And then within that, you have people that also look at interest. Interest falls within motivation. My area, I tend to look at just beliefs, engagement, and attitude towards motivation. But interest tends to fall more on the intrinsic value scale.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, if you're told that you're great at math and your household reinforces it, guess what? More than likely, you're going to have an interest in math, pretty high. The problem we have is that when you have a high interest in math and you're told you're good at math, but yet when you begin to see challenging tasks, guess what's going to happen to your interest in math?
I would suspect it might wane a little bit.
It'll wane. And so this is when I come back and say, this is why we need to be looking at this idea of incremental, that motivation, you can build motivation in children so they can become good problem solvers. But that takes time. That takes practice.
Well, we're going to take a brief break. And when Central Standard returns on KCUR, we'll continue this conversation with Michael. And we'll hear from a math teacher who's just trying to do that. He's introducing his students to Algebra 1 before the ninth grade. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. This is Central Standard. Before the break, we were talking with Michael Orozco, a professor in the School of Education at KU, about research he's done that might help us unlock student success in math using an understanding of motivation. And now I want to bring in someone with some very real experience in these daily opportunities for math motivation, Cornelius Mitchell. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for having me.
And if you weren't here with us right now, where else would you be?
I'd be teaching algebra in third block, Center Middle School.
Part of the Center School District, right? Cornelius, as you've been listening to Michael before the break, did what he was saying resonate with you?
Oh, it totally resonated with me, especially when you're talking about the cycling piece. Well, first off, a lot of my kids wouldn't know to go to a cycling because that's not, it's not important to them, it's not relevant to them. And so a lot of the things that I bring into my classroom, one, I talk about money because they love money. They love the latest fashions. And then we talk about celebrities. They love whether it's NBA, whether it's music. It doesn't matter. Everything is fair game in Mitchell's 212.
And so some of the examples might include, like, you know, if LeBron James was putting in interest, you know, for an investment, that kind of thing?
Yes. Whether it's an investment, what is he preparing for after the NBA? Is he taking care of his money? Is he surrounding himself with people that will help better himself after he's done playing basketball? About the kids that he sends to college? Those type of things. And so just because that you have a gift in playing a particular sport or music or whatever, are you preparing yourself for after? And what I teach is I teach kids how to think. And I try to remove that phobia of math by promoting this is not just a math class. This is me helping you how to think differently.
And Cornelius, did you always love math yourself?
Math was a challenge for me. I vividly remember seventh grade, and there was two tracks. You could be on the fast track or the regular seventh grade math, and I wasn't chosen, and that rubbed me the wrong way. And so ever since then, I knew inside of me I should have been on that fast track, so I was going to prove that teacher wrong. And so I majored in math, and here I am, umpteen years later, teaching kids how to think differently about math.
And in your district, they've changed the way, they changed when they introduced students to Algebra 1. Why did that change happen?
That change happened because our district was searching for things that promoted college. And so there was a school in Maryland that had a track record of sending kids off to college. And one of those benchmarks that they had talked about that every college student had, and it was algebra early on. And so they Center School District did the research. They came back. They proposed it to the math teachers. And that's what we did. But we couldn't just start in the eighth grade. We had to back it all the way up, sixth grade, seventh grade, and eighth grade, to prepare them for algebra in the eighth grade.
Hmm. And Michael, this challenge of doing higher level math a little bit sooner, that might impact motivation, as we were kind of discussing in the previous segment. What does that give you pause? Does this seem like a good idea when we're thinking about motivation?
Well, it is, because what we're doing is, if you have a group of kids that haven't done well with algebra historically, let's say you have poor Latinos inner city that have not done, and the data shows that, what we are seeing is that if you try to introduce algebra later, yet they haven't liked just basic math, could you imagine what's going to happen once you try to get them in an algebra school? And it may be too late. And algebra is the building block. It's the gateway to calculus. It's one of the building blocks you need for calculus. So this is what I've been trying to do with the research through the U.S. Department of Education, is that we're doing early intervention earlier. sixth grade, I'm back into third grade, into second grade, working with teachers on word problems. Something Cornelius brought up, too, that I think is critical to this, what he's doing is, as you have these skill sets, these curriculums coming out, one thing that I don't see a lot of teachers doing is what Cornelius was talking about is culture-responsive teaching. Can you connect it to something they've seen on TV or to their neighborhoods? And as you do that, you'll begin to see the instructional engagement towards more heavier problem-solving tasks, and the motivation begins to grow towards math.
Mm-hmm. And is there an objective to get kids engaged in this harder stuff earlier because it can be more useful, Cornelius?
Yes, I do believe that it helps develop their thought process. Everything goes back to a thought process. And once you have those thought processes in place, then you are able to critically think.
And, Michael, continue. If
you think about that word problem you gave, that one on cycling, everyday mundane word problem, I tell people, those word problems are going to pop up over there. But it's in the skill sets that you take, how you formulate the problem-solving method within that problem-solving, within that simple word problem. That's the building block to more critical skills that Cornelius is trying to do in algebra. But you have to teach that earlier so kids can get into that type of mode.
Mm-hmm. And Cornelius, are there examples that you can think of when you've noticed like motivation being a real issue for some of your students in the classroom?
I can speak of just last block that I was just in. I tend to watch facial expressions of my students. And today, because we just started school last week, I introduced a graphing calculator. Well, we introduced this graphing calculator early because this is a calculator that these kids can use on the ACT test. And so we start prepping them on this big graphic calculator. And so the facial demeanor that this particular student had, she stood up and she got all upset. And so, I just went over and talked to her and just said, well, you got to communicate with me. What is wrong? Well, it's too many buttons and this and that. And so I said, I understand you're frustrated, but why don't we work through this together? And that's one thing that I do preach in the classroom. It's not just you, the individual. We're working together, all of us, collaboratively. And so once we get there working collaboratively, I think that we will have arrived.
I think that's really interesting that for you, it's like these little moments to understand people's like motivation and points of frustration. But one of the things that Michael's talking about is, doing this fairly quick assessment, this BEAMS assessment with students to kind of address their math motivation in aggregate. How realistic is it to add another assessment to, the rigors of, just trying to get through the content that you need to in a day?
I think it plays to your advantage as far as adding another assessment because we have benchmarking at the Center School District. And
what is benchmarking?
Benchmarking is where we have our set curriculum and we've broken down our Common Core standards based on what they said that it
where
meets.
People should be.
And so we have a chart in our mathematics classrooms stating the student's name and what you've completed. And so it's kind of a challenge to each student. So if little Johnny has completed benchmark 1 through 5 and Susie Q is only on benchmark 2, well, what can we do to help promote Susie Q to get caught up? And so it kind of the peer-to-peer relationships that they can put certain pressure on as well as the teacher will allow everybody to succeed.
And Michael, does that resonate with you, this kind of benchmarking and, understanding, where students are?
And I think that Cornelius is driving a point there is that when we start comparing one student to the other, it may not be the best thing for motivation, for developing motivation. For the reason being, then that student begins to compare themselves to each other. And if you see somebody that's perceived as smart, that may be an indication that that person thinks he's not doing well in math and becomes more demotivation. You know, and back to this idea we've been talking about, Matt, with this instrument, because I've been a teacher, and I know we're doing a lot of assessment, but the biggest challenge I can't emphasize is that a lot of the assessments we're doing are really not looking at cognitive development. And we need to continue to do that in schools, because cognitive development really is a precursor to understanding how we're developing problem-solving skills. And this instrument I developed in mind with teachers that they can do it in 3 minutes or less. And it just gives them a quick indication where their students are at with math after a segment or quarter.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by cognitive development versus other kinds of assessments?
Okay, so Cornelius was hitting on something. We were talking about this idea that curriculums are developed by curriculum people, sometimes researchers. But if they develop it on population X, the items, the work that goes in there relates to item X. So for example, I was in California doing a classroom observation. The observation was, I was watching a teacher do word problems, teaching word problems. The example was related to skiing and how this person had bought skis for $300 and got it at 20% discount. So she went through indirect and explicit model for the students. Afterward, turned the students in loose to do their work. They didn't get it. Well, the problem with this wasn't necessarily that she needed to teach the concept of multiplication percentages. The problem was that that curriculum wasn't aligned to the needs of these kids, because afterwards we debriefed, she talked, she says, what do you think went wrong here? I said, I think you did some good things about it, but I said, you failed to contextualize. I said, where are you at? She says, well, I'm in Southern California. I said, what's the temperature out there? It's about 98 degrees. I said, how many of these kids do you think have ever skied? None of them. How many of them do you think they can go out and pay $300-$400 for a pair of skis? Well, none of them. And then she came back and she looked at me. She said, I must sound like a complete racist. I said, you're not a racist. I said, but I think I can work with you. And I've been working with that school prior to getting here with trying to make these behaviors more culture responsive. And then that relates to how we're shaping motivation.
Cornelius, I saw you nodding and smiling while Michael was talking.
Yeah, I mean, I am so with you when you're talking about your cognitive development. But then on the flip side, I'll bring my students know me because I keep it real with them. And so what I mean by that is, so you're walking around with a pair of $200 shoes on, but you don't bring your supplies to class. And so meeting them where they're at, but also raising those expectations for them is just not acceptable for you to slack off just because that you're not good. And so so you have that combined with their peer-to-peer pressure that they're putting on themselves. At the end, I mean, we have a nice finished product that those kids, when they go to that next level classroom, they know that they're supposed to be there. Why? Because they put in the work the previous years and the state test that deemed whatever they said that they were, but they score proficient in advance.
And Cornelius, when research like this, the kind that Michael does, comes out and, you know, and advances math instruction, how has that changed your classroom? Do you feel that your class, I mean, just my outside perspective, not even being an educator, I feel that just paradigms, what we were just talking about, cultural responsive teaching, Common Core, I feel like the classroom is changing kind of rapidly. Is that your experience?
I do believe that it is changing rapidly. Everything is high-paced, and everything is right now. We have to have immediate feedback on everything that we're doing, whether it's technology, and a lot of the kids, they want to do away with pencil and paper and do everything on the computer. But it's my belief that you can't ever, the paper, you have to have the pencil and the paper to get a feel for what you're doing.
And Michael, what do you see as the next, biggest challenge to wider math aptitude for our future? And how do we help address that problem?
Well, one of the big challenge curriculum Cornelius is hitting on is this idea of time. That a kid has to be at grade level at a certain month, at a certain time of year. Time is critical to understanding how to develop problem solving in children. And I've learned through my years of research that if you want to work with, develop good problem solvers, it's going to take time. But because everything has been standardized and Cornelius is hating, they have to hit certain benchmarks on certain dates. What happens if you have a group of kids that don't get those benchmarks? Don't hit those benchmarks. Do you go back and reteach those benchmarks, or do you send them on and forget about those benchmarks? Or does one thing lead to another? And this goes back to the example I was talking about earlier, is that if these kids aren't doing well, Cornelius is at the high school. I tend to work more at the elementary middle school, that if they're not doing well at the elementary school and they don't continue to hit these benchmarks, and these benchmarks lead to higher order thinking skills, where do you think we're going to place them, Matt, if they're not doing well?
Yeah,
we come back to special education. And really, it could have been that these kids may need it because they're second language learners. They're acquiring new content in the English language. They may need it just more time related to the materials to become better problem solvers.
Hmm. Well, as we look to that challenge in the future, it's nice to know that Michael Orozco will be helping trying to address it, along with Cornelius Mitchell. Thank you both guys for taking time out of your day to join us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Central Standard is going to take one more break, and when we return, we shift from math education to nursing education and how Kansas is offering an innovative way of educating the nurses of tomorrow.